Okay, Boker to everybody. I think we can get started. Hope everybody is doing well. We are continuing Perkei Avot, Perek Gimel, third chapter, Mishnah Chet in my Mishnah. At the 8, 3, 8, it may be 9 in yours or 7. Some of the Mishnah are different. So we were talking last week, we ended off how learning and davening are two separate mitzvot. That was sort of the last thing we spoke about. And I mentioned Rav Soloveitchik's beautiful idea that to daven, you have to have a childlike personality. You have to be dependent. You have to realize your total dependence on others. We pray because we need things. If we don't need anything, we don't have to pray. That's one of the reasons prayer is so hard. Maybe it's a little bit easier these days, but when things are going well, it's very hard to pray because prayer comes from a sense of need, dependence. We're nobodies, we have nothing. And learning is the exact opposite. Learning is total independence, critical analysis, not accepting things if you don't understand them. And therefore, that's the sort of idea behind you can't interrupt one for the other. You cannot, the matter of fact, the halach is, I think I mentioned this was at the end, we were in a bit of a hurry, that you're not allowed to learn before you daven. That's the real halacha, or at least you're not allowed to learn anything semi-complicated. Maybe you can just say like a plain halacha. If you forget Yalla V'Yavod Mariv or something, you don't have to repeat the Shmon Esrei. But because the mindset is very different, and you need to clear the mind from learning to daven. Anyways, that's so we the Mishnah talks about you're not allowed to stop in the middle of learning, but you're not allowed to also stop in the middle of prayer so that you can learn, because it's a two different things. This is a big Yetzer Hara for people who are Torah scholars. They have a big Yetzer Hara that in the middle of Chazarat Hashatz, they'll take out a Sefer and start to learn, which, okay, I understand. I've been guilty of that on occasion. Although I don't think for a while, I try to be careful about that. Davening time is davening time, and learning time is learning time. Okay, that was just to summarize the last point we did last week. As we'll see, you know, I do review 1 minute. I spend the last minute of this year trying to very quickly review every moment, because review, as we're going to see in this Mishnah, is really the most important part of learning. It's people don't like it because they feel like they're not doing anything new. People like new and exciting and interesting. But if you want to really learn, you have to review. We've spoken about this already. It's come up in the past. We forget the half of what we learn within an hour. So I'm not really reviewing everything we did last week, but a little, and add a few new points. But Mishnah Chet, Rav Dostai, Rabbi Yona, Mishum Rabbi Meir Omer. This is actually very unusual in Pirkei Avot. Generally, we have very often in the Gemara that people quote earlier sources. Somebody quotes something in the name of somebody else, but it's you don't really find that in Pirkei Avot. In other words, the Gemara Abaye said in the name of this one and the name of this one. Like Rabbi Yehuda is always quoting Rabbi Shmuel. Pirkei Avot is not so much people quoting other people; it's people quoting themselves. As far as I can recall, I check more carefully. This is the only place in Pirkei Avot where somebody's quoting what some other rabbi says. Rav Dostai, Rav Yoni, Mishum Rabbi Meir, from Rav Meir. Now, by the way, it's interesting, the word Mishum, I know this sounds like a technical point, but it's interesting. You have very often in the Gemara, who to quote, I think Rav Meir also quoting Mishum Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. When it says Mishum, it means he didn't hear it directly. In other words, he's quoting in the name of. If he's quoting it directly, it would say Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. So Rav Yehuda says, Rav says. So that means he learned directly from him. When the Talmud adds in the word Mishum, it means that he heard it, but indirectly. It's like most of my 99%, maybe 99.9% of what I quote from Rabbi Soloveitchik, I didn't hear directly from Rabbi Soloveitchik. I was not his student, because by the time I came to Yeshiva University, he wasn't really well anymore. He was still teaching a little bit, and I heard a few shiurim he gave, but he wasn't really so well. But all my teachers or students, so I heard them quoting him, and of course his writings. But so I'm like, it's Mishum Rabbi Soloveitchik. When I quote Rav Shachter, so that's because I heard it directly, because I was in a shiur for 4 years. So when I'm quoting him, I'm quoting, so I hope I'm quoting correctly, I'm quoting things I heard directly. So the Talmud was edited with such great precision. These little minor points are very important to it. People sometimes you get the impression you learn Gemara sort of all over the place. They're going on tangents. There are no tangents in the Talmud. They're one topic leads to another. There's no such thing as a tangent in the Talmud. And part of what goes on a little bit today is people are trying to figure out sort of the link between the Agada and the Halakha. Why is a certain Agadic passage put into the halakhic context in which it's quoted? Just to give you one very brief example, so for example, all the mitzvot about the destruction of the temple are in Gittin. All the stories about the destruction of the temple are in Masechet Gittin, which talks about a divorce, because the exile and the destruction is kind of like a divorce of God and the Jewish people. Everything was edited with unbelievable exactness and precision. You often don't get that feeling. It's often not taught that way, but you have to, the Gemara was edited. That's one of the reasons the Bavli is used more than the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi was never properly edited because of persecution. And most of the Torah scholars had left to go to live in Babel. The Jerusalem Talmud was never properly edited, which means it's extremely hard to learn. Then Rashi didn't write a commentary on it, which means it's impossible to learn. And so if it says Amar Le, very often in the discussion in Talmud, you'll have a discussion between rabbis. So sometimes the rabbis are sitting in the same room, in the same Beit Midrash. So say Amar Le, he said to him. And sometimes they're living 100 years apart, and they're living, one's living in Israel, one's living in Babylonia. So it says Amar. In other words, I'm responding to a statement made by some rabbi 100 years ago. I never met him. But the Gemara will say, he said, and I said. But I'm not saying to him. Whenever you'll see in the Talmud, Aleph Lamed, Amar Leh, he said to him, that means they're talking to each other. So these little hints are little things just to tell you. And the fact that the Gemara will often quote a four-line thing, like this one said a name of this one, a name of this one, it's very important. Who is the originator of this statement? And for all kinds of reasons, to give proper credit, to know who said what, and to raise contradiction. The Talmud's very exact, and what may seem a little bit strange to us, they want to have everything, the right person, the right place, who said what, when. Anyway, so this is Rav Dostai, Rabbi Yanai, saying what he heard, Rabbi Meir, Omer. Okay. Kol ha-shokhech d'var achad mi-mishnato. This is a scary Mishnah. Somebody who forgets one thing from what they learned, d'var achad mi-mishnato, from his learning, ma'leha lafa katuv kilu mitchayev b'nafsho. The Torah considers it as if he is guilty of a capital offense. He should forfeit his life. That's what we had in the last Mishnah. You're walking in the street and you're learning Torah and you see a beautiful tree and say, wow, you stop learning to comment on the beautiful tree. We spoke about what that means exactly. You're also should forfeit your life, perhaps. You're guilty, ke'ilu, as if. So this is a little bit wild. It's why I can control myself. You know, that when I'm learning Torah, I don't interrupt my Torah. So, okay, I understand why it's very bad. In the middle of learning, you're not supposed to interrupt. You're not supposed to check your messages on your iPhone and whatever, and anything, all the things we do to interrupt, whatever. Modern man doesn't know how to do one thing at a time. But in the Gemara, they want us to daven at this time, learn at this time, whatever we do, do it right and do it 100% focused. But to say that you can't forget something, this is that's unbelievable. What do you mean? We're normal people. We, of course, forget most of what we learn. So the Bartanura, the classical commentaries, of course, it's that we'll sort of nishna, allude to it, hints to it, but doesn't directly say it. We're talking about that's only if you don't review. In other words, if you forget because you didn't review, I learned it once, I go on. So then that's terrible. But if you review and you're normal people, who doesn't forget anything? I think they said in the name of Rav Moshe Feinstein, he once said that until the age of 60, he never forgot anything. He never forgot what he learned. Or they have that. That's the cute stuff. Again, like I always say with all these stories, I don't know if they're true or not true or they're safe, but whatever, they give you an indication of some the perception. But I have quoted that Ravnasan Adler, who I assume many people don't really know who Ravnasan Adler is, because he left us no writings, as far as I know. Ravnasan Adler was the Rebbe of the Chatham Sofer. That was his main Rebbe. Chatham Sofer, everybody has heard of, I think. Rav Moshe Sofer, 1762, 1839, whatever. It's we'll just say one of the most influential rabbis of the last 200 years, halakhically and socially, with his, you know, the leading, the most prominent person leading the attack on the Reform movement, which started in his lifetime, of course, halakhically, and Chadash Asrmin HaTorah. So his Rebbe, Ravnasan Adler, was an interesting person. So he didn't write anything. He didn't write anything. And apparently the story goes, they asked him why. He says, well, you're not supposed to write down the oral law. The oral law was only written down because of a fear people would forget. Exile, it was too hard to remember. It was getting too big. You know, if you have to have one book, okay. But if you're getting more and more and more cases and more things, it's impossible to remember everything. So we were allowed to write it down. And as the Gemara says, Eit lasot l'shem hefer toratecha, it was a time to act for God. They nullified your Torah. In other words, it was a prohibition. It was a Torah prohibition to write down the Torah. But we had no choice. If we wouldn't write it down, we wouldn't have any Torah. So better to violate, to nullify God's Torah, so to speak. That's the verse the Talmud quotes, so we can maintain the Torah. So Rav Nassan Adler apparently said he doesn't have any, there's no leaning. That's for other people. But he never forgot anything. So he has no permission to write down the Torah, because he remembers everything, so he's not allowed to write down Torah. So it's quite a step. I wasn't there, and I don't know, but that's, I heard, it's probably not even correct, even if it is correct. In other words, even if it's true that he never forgot anything, and he, there are people like that, whatever, remember almost everything, have photographic memories and are brilliant. It's probably not true. Once the permission was given to write down the Torah, it didn't matter what the reason is. We have that in everything in Judaism. We get you know frustrated at times, like you can't drink non-Jewish wine from a non-Jew because you may intermarry. Yeah, but it's not going to apply in this case. That's ridiculous. Blah blah blah. It doesn't matter. Once the law is passed, you can't go through a red light at 3 o'clock in the morning, even if there are no cars for 10 miles. It doesn't matter. When law gets an independent, the law may be motivated by a particular reason, but once the law is passed, the law is the law. So I would assume that works this way too. Once the rabbis established the permission to write the oral law, you're even allowed to write it down, even if you don't need it, even if you won't remember, if you won't forget anything. But that's just an interesting idea. But the Mishnah says, forgetting, wow, that's terrible. But normal people forget. So this is only if you don't review. All right. In a sense, that's harder to us, because then it puts the onus on us. The Bartanura, we're going to have to see. The Rav Avadya Bartanura, the classic commentary, says, what's the fear here? And he really takes the whole sting out of the Mishnah. He just lowers the whole thing. He says, what's the reason is because we're afraid to make a mistake. In other words, it's a halachic reason that if a rabbi forgets things, you ask him a question, is the chicken kosher, to take sort of the old classic case, and he forgets, he'll make him a mistake. In other words, the reason you have to review is in order to don't make it a mistake when you render a decision. But for normal people who don't render decisions, they just don't remember what they learned in Daf Yomi, because how can you remember? You learn a Daf an hour and 7 pages a day. It's impossible to remember. That's one of the criticisms of Daf Yomi. It's so fast, you don't really remember anything. But okay, so it wouldn't apply. It only applies because of fear of making a mistake. If you say that, and even if you don't say that, you might say that this doesn't apply today, because today, since everything is written down. In other words, the question is, was this Mishnah talking about a time before the Mishnah was allowed to be written? In other words, we can understand this Mishnah when there's nothing written down. So then not forgetting is really important. You got to really, really learn it well, because you have no access to the information. But once we wrote down the Torah, once we wrote down the Torah, then I won't forget. I may not have it in my brain, but I have access to the information. So it could be this whole Mishnah doesn't apply at all. And that's what the Bartanur seems to be hinting at. It's for a halakhic decision today. So you look it up. Nobody, it's impossible for, there's no person alive. The greatest Torah scholar, it's impossible to know everything. It just cannot be. I don't know, I remember hearing years ago that there's more information in the New York Times, in one issue of the New York Times, than there is, than a person in the Middle Ages learned in their entire lifetime. In other words, how much information, you know, what did you have to know in the 1200s? In other words, how much, to be the world's doctor, there weren't 98 subspecialties. Medicine had an advance, so there was very little to know. You know, if you lived 1,000 years ago, you didn't have to worry about learning the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch and this and that. You know, it's you live before the time of the Gemara. There's just the Mishnah. So it could be this whole Mishnah, if it's a practical thing, then it really wouldn't apply because we have access to information. That's why some say the Talmud has a discussion in a few places. What's more important, an analyst or a photographic memory? As the Gemara discusses, a Sinai and Rokei Harim. I think we mentioned this many weeks ago. A Sinai is a person, he knows everything. He spits back all the information. Tell him, he spits it back. He doesn't analyze it. He doesn't classify it. He doesn't distinguish it. That's the Sinai. The Ochr Harim, like Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, he was an Ochr Harim. I mentioned the story. They asked him, somebody told him, Tosfot says something. He says, Tosfot didn't say that. So they asked him, do you know every Tosfot? He said, no, I don't know every Tosfot. But I know Tosfot couldn't have said such a thing. So that's a very different type of learning than the person who knows every Tosfot by heart, but doesn't necessarily understand how one Tosfot relates to another. It's a totally, so what's more important, analysis or information? That's really Sinai or Ochr Harim. And the Gemara comes to the conclusion, Sinai is more important. The information is more important because you can't analyze without information. If you don't have the Sinai is like the bread and butter, and the analysis is the dessert. It's very nice, but without the bread and butter. So many people say today that's not true, because that was in a time when you couldn't write down the Torah. So it's very, very important to have people who had information. That's what a Tana meant. The rabbis of the Mishnah, a Tana meant one who taught what's in the, who knew all the teachings by heart. The Tanaim learned all the teachings by heart. But in an era where everything is written down, then it's not really so important because you can access it. And today, I would say without a computer, you can't really be, computers gives us access, you know, all the programs they have to look up stuff. That's a separate discussion. Anyway, but all this takes away from the sting of the Mishnah. I think the Mishnah is saying an important point, like the original point of the Bartanur. Review is really, really important, and you're very guilty if you forget. And, you can give me all the excuses in the world, it's not so important anymore, but the bottom line is if you don't review what you learned, you really won't know very much. Okay, so the Tiferet Yisrael says, of course, this is hyperbola. Obviously it's not true, because what are you going to say? What if I don't learn at all? So it doesn't say anywhere, if I don't learn at all, I'm guilty of my life is to forfeit my life. We don't say that. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah of learning Torah. You can learn the Torah, as Rabbi Ziering mentioned. That's the Talmud says one can technically fulfill the mitzvah of learning Torah by saying Shema every morning and every evening. You have to engage in Torah day and night. So the Talmud says, bottom line is, it's okay. You say the Shema in the morning, you're learning some Torah, and you say the Shema in the evening. You won't know Torah that way, but you'll learn Torah. That's the mitzvah. Then the Gemara says you're not allowed to tell that to an Am Haaretz. You're not allowed to tell that to people who are not so learned, because they say, I don't have to learn. I'll just say Shema. So obviously, I consider everybody in this here on the Zoom class not Am Haaretzim. Otherwise, I wouldn't be allowed to tell you that you can fulfill the mitzvah to learn if you just learn Shema morning after. And I think then the Gemara says there's a second opinion. You have to look it up. I forget. Terrible. That you should tell this to a Talmid Chacham. And again, this is a psychological argument. Do you tell people, if you tell people that they have to do much more than they can, it's too hard. I'm not going to do it. So sometimes it's good to tell them the minimum. But if you tell them the minimum, They won't stress to do any higher. So that's sort of a debate practically what's better. But anyway, the Divergio, clearly it's hyperbola. So he didn't learn. So obviously it's better to learn and forget than not to learn at all. Or so it would appear. One could maybe argue on that a little bit. I don't know. One can say it's better to do a good job than no job at all. In other words, if you're going to learn like nothing, don't learn. But I don't think we would say that. We'd say, and you know, it's always to do a little bit. And again, this reads, and what the Bartonura, by the way, is saying, he adds a second. In other words, what's important here is the knowledge. In other words, the idea, whatever, it's not the act of learning, it's the knowing the information. And that's the thing, Reb Zevin, I mentioned as a beautiful article, that there are two aspects. There's a mitzvah to learn Torah. The act of engaging in the study of Torah is ennobling, is uplifting, even if you don't learn anything. And that's why the Talmud says, the Mishnah talks on schar halicha, the reward for going to a shir, to walking to a shir, the reward for being in the shir. The Talmud itself said that most of the people would go to the rabbi's lectures on Shabbos afternoon, let's say, they wouldn't really understand them. But it's okay. They get the reward for being there, being in an atmosphere where people are learning. So that's one aspect of learning. Then there's a second aspect of learning that is, of course, to know the information. And those two are not always the same. And, you know, what's more important, one can argue what's more important. I think today the stress is put on, we've, I think, gone to one, the extreme. We're putting all the stress on learning as opposed to knowing. In other words, I just sort of reread the Charles Stamper's book on the Lithuanian yeshiva. It's a fascinating book on mainly on Valazhin, and then a little bit on Slobodka and Tells. And it's a fascinating guy. Charles Stamper is I don't know what today he is, but he was the head of the Department of Jewish History at Hebrew University. He grew up in America, Orthodox, you know, guy, and a fascinating book. So Tells Yeshiva was the first. Tells was a very modern yeshiva in Europe. It was considered the most like modern yeshiva. They were the only yeshiva that had levels. In other words, you went to Valashin, there was one shir. Everybody went to the same shir. Tells, they had five levels of shirim. So the brighter student, you know, and they like all modern education does that. Well, not others. It was what you would call basically, you know, streaming. And they also, Tells had tests. Classical yeshivas don't have any tests. Today, you go to learn in wherever, you can name all the yeshivas. When all your children, our children go to Israel for the year. So almost none of the places they go to have any testing. I think it's a big mistake. I think that's they say it takes away from the learning for the sake of learning. I don't know. I don't buy into that. I don't think that's true at all. I think that learning, knowing is very important. The only way to get people to know something is if you test them, because that's the only way they review, and that's the only way. In a university, we test people. That's you have to finish something. There's a curriculum. Very few yeshiva have a curriculum. It's a whole different approach. That works in Valazhin, where people like Rav Kook are learning in the yeshiva, you know, and that's okay. They don't need a curriculum. They don't need tests. But normal people, once yeshivas get opened up to everybody, which is what we have today for the first time in Jewish history ever, that everybody gets a Jewish education, never happened before. Everybody learned how to read and write, not everybody. Many people came to shul, they didn't know how to daven. That's why the chazan repeated. But, you know, it's you. But the idea that you would learn beyond 14, 15, anything serious, that's unheard of until our very wealthiest like generation and all of Jewish history. So it's a wonderful thing. But it means you have to change the whole style of the curriculum. Rav Schechter, and this I heard directly from Rav Schechter, told us that, you know, it's a huge mistake. What they, anybody here who learned Gemara, you can put it in the chat box or raise your hand. I'm willing to bet those of you, the first Gemara you learned, what was the first Gemara everybody learned here in your life? What was the first Gemara you were exposed to? Do you remember? Maybe I'll get into trouble here. Put it in the chat box. I even think you can unmute yourself. What was the first Gemara everybody learned? I think for sure anybody over 40. Oh, brachot. Wow, that's cool. Okay, so well, rachav. So no, I mean, what masechet in Talmud did everybody learn first? So I don't know. When I learned, everybody learned. Makos. Okay, so I guess I'm a little wrong here. Elimitzias, there you go. So maybe it's an H thing. Elimitzias shalov, eluchayav lahachriz. The second chapter in Bava Metzia. People learned Elimitziyot, and it's a very difficult Gemara. Yeush shalomidat, it's a retroactive, what's the word I'm even, giving up hope retroactively. Does that have legal implications? If I lose an object, so if you gave up hope of ever finding it, you lose a $20 bill, you know you're never going to get it back because there's no way to identify it. So I can keep the $20 bill. But what if you don't know you lost the $20 bill? But I know you lost a $20 bill. But when you found out, you would have lost hope. So is that retroactive losing of hope means that when I picked it up, it's considered you didn't lose it? So that's a famous argument between Abaye and Rava. And that's one of the six cases who felt like very complicated. But that's what they, that's what everybody learned for years. In the modern schools today, they've gone away from that, thank God. Then why did they do that? Because it was a very difficult Gemara. And anybody who came to yeshiva in the 1700s, 1800s knew the basics. What did they need help in? They needed help in the most complicated things. So the great Torah scholars would give shiurim, would give lectures on the most complex Talmud subject. So that's what they did in Europe. They opened up yeshivas in America for 12-year-old kids. And, you know, in grade five, they start teaching Gemara at 10 years old. And, okay, they learned Elim Metzias in Europe. We're going to learn Elim Metzias. That's a different world. In Europe, you couldn't get into yeshiva. It's a totally different thing. It makes no sense. So Rav Shechter used to complain. He said, you should teach brachot. Exactly. You should teach Megillah. You start with the simple things, and then you move to the complex things. So people, you know, they've moved the complexity, whatever, they're copying without, you know, putting educational method. But anyways, it was Tel's yeshiva that really was the first yeshiva to develop testing and levels and what you learn and everything. So it's very, just very fascinating. But getting back to our Mishnah, so what the Mishnah is very concerned, what you know. The mission held kol ha-shocheach. In other words, knowledge is more important than learning. So if knowledge is more important than learning, you have need tests. And maybe in Valashin, you didn't need any testing. But here you need a test. Even in Valashin, if you wanted to get smicha, they gave you a test. They would never give you smicha without giving you a test. Yeah, the mission, okay. All right, that's the first half of the Mishnah. Then let's continue. Perhaps even, and the Mishnah quotes, Shenema raki shamer lecha shmor nashka, be very, very careful. Pentishka. Lest you forget, that's a pasuk in the Torah. We read it right before the Ten Commandments in Bet Hanan, right? Okay. Be very careful, lest you forget. So the Gemara Mishnah says, "Yechol afilu takva lav mishanto." Is this possible? Even if you, you know, your mind just is incapable of remembering anything. So no, that's okay. It says, "Tamunu ar pen yasuru," that you remove them from your heart. Eino chayav benafsho at sheyishiv yisurim milibo. The Mishnah seems to say you have to actively want to forget. After one, which I would say, who wants to actively forget? Very few people. There are, the Gemara has a story, I forget about who now, see? Somebody moved from Bavel Teretz Yisrael. So I believe he fasted for 40 days, right? That's always 40 is a transformative number, 40 days. It's signing all the 40s in the Talmud, in the Torah, all transformative numbers. He fasted for 40 days to forget the Torah he learned in Bavel, because he wanted the Torah of Eretz Yisrael. Fascinating story, whatever that means exactly. In other words, it's a different, it's true sometimes you want to get out of the old knowledge. Sometimes you got to knock the knowledge out to replace it with something good, you know. But anyway, so that's what it appears. Only a person who actively tries to forget things. So that's nobody. But the way the commentaries explain, active, not reviewing is actively trying to forget. It's not just, it's not just active, either passively by not reviewing. But whatever, the Mishnah talks about the great importance of review and knowledge and not forgetting. Okay, Mishnah Tet. Mishnah Tet. Rav Chanina ben Dosa Omer. So just a few words on Rav Chanina ben Dosa. I mentioned last week that many, including Rav Dostai, Rav Yonai, many of the teachers in Pirkei Avot only appear in Pirkei Avot, are not so well known. They were obviously experts in ethical teachings, etc. Rav Chanina ben Dosa appears not so often, but he does appear a few places, perhaps most famously in Brachot. I'm just looking at Rav Chanina ben Dosa. He wasn't like many of these rabbis. According to the Wikipedia article, I'll say I just was, you know what they said. Wikipedia said he's never quoted in the Talmud on a halachic issue. He's never quoted on a legal matter. But he's perhaps the most famous reference to him is in the Mishnah in Brachot. The Mishnah says that when Rav Hanina ben Dosa, here, he would daven for sick people. He would turn to people. He was the person people went to daven. There wasn't rain, whatever. He was like a very, very pious person. And the Mishnah says, here, the Mishnah is like this. This is important. We're coming to Rosh Hashanah and lots of extra bali tefillah. A person who makes a mistake when he davens, not so good. That's a bad sign. If the chazan, the shaliach tzibur, the one davening on our behalf, makes a mistake, siman rav lishtuchav, then it's bad for the whole congregation. We sent some guy, he messed up. Again, this, okay, mifnesha shlucho shel adam kimoto. Because the person we send is our messenger. He's our proxy, like an agency. So what he's doing is considered like what we're doing. If you send up the guy to daven, he doesn't know how to daven properly. So it reflects bad. It's bad for the community. So that's very important. You have to have whatever. Okay, so Amru Alav of Rav Hanina ben Dosa. So the Mishnah says, they tell about Rav Hanina ben Dosa. Keshehaya mitpalel al cholim, when he would pray for sick people. So you see right away, he was the person you went to when people were sick, you know, say a prayer. He was very pious and he had a closer link to God, so to speak. So while he would die, he said, this one's going to live, this one's going to die. That's pretty woe, like unatanatokef, you know. How do you know? What are you God? How do you know? So Amar Lahem, if the prayers flow fluently from my lips, then I know the prayers are accepted in heaven. And if not, and if they don't flow fluently, they know they're going to be ripped off. So it, on the one hand, it sounds a little chutzpahdik, you know, but on the other hand, the Gemara has that. Sometimes people knew what there were. Some of the commentaries explain he didn't directly say, just through his actions, you could tell he was smiling or upset. There, you could tell by his facial expression. You know, he would dumb for this person, then he looked away. Oh, this person's going to live, this one's going to die. But you have that. That's the same story with Choni Hamagal, the one, you know, drew the circle and prayed for rain. And Shimon Ben Shetach said, you know, I should, he said, God, I want this rain. And it started to pour. And it started to drizzle. It said, no, I want drizzle. We want real rain here. We need real rain. So it started to thunder. It was ruining everything. It was hailing. It was too bad. Said, no, God, I'm not that. I want good, normal rain. So, and that's what happened. So Shimon Shetach is watching. He said, you know, Choni, I have to excommunicate you. The chutzpah that you talk to God like that is unbelievable. I'm going to excommunicate you. But what can I do? God obviously loves you. He listens to you like a child who sins before their father and the father kisses them. So obviously God is spring. So, but you see, Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa was the one who people turned to in prayer, very pious, and his prayer could be accepted. You'll understand now why. And then the Gemara says in Tanit that the whole world was sustained because of the merit of Rav Hanina ben Dosa. These are, like, in other words, why did this generation merit having the land of Israel? Why does this generation merit food? Because of Rav Hanina ben Dosa. And the Gemara says, but he himself, he was very poor, very, very poor. And he used to eat a pound of carobs, a cob, whatever that is, a measure of carobs from one week to another, from Shabbos to Shabbos. He was very poor, but everybody else sustained the world. So maybe with that, you can understand why the next Mishnah Tet, why he says, so in the last Mishnah, we learned how important it is to know things. You can't forget, you have to know. However, more important than knowing anything is Yirat Chet, your fear of sin. Whose ever fear of sin is greater than his wisdom or knowledge, Chachmato mit kayemet, then his wisdom will endure. But anybody who's smarter, you know, he's a smart aleck. He's too smart. He's smarter than his fear of God. His wisdom will not have any endurance. It will not be meaningful. So you see right away, of course, the importance of learning is character development. I mentioned Cheryl Stamper's book that I was rereading this week. So on the section on Slobodka, the Slobodka Yeshiva was a Musar Yeshiva. That was Rav Nosson Zvi Pinkel, the idea of Musar. Rav Yisrael Salanter founded this movement that people should focus on character development. Very controversial, because the implication of it was that when you study Talmud, it doesn't develop your character. And we need specific work on character. It was a huge debate. The Slobodka Yeshiva was founded as a Musar Yeshiva. It broke into two. This was because of the big fights over the value of Musar, Knesset Yisrael, Knesset Yitzchak, whatever. And Slobodka Yeshiva broke in two. But I don't know, it's not exact. And so Yirat Chet, fear of heaven, fear of sin, has to become before learning character. The Rambam goes so far to say that a person who doesn't, is not hagun, is not proper, he's a sinning person, however you define that, morally corrupt person, you can't teach them Torah. First you have to make them a good person, then teach them Torah. You could argue the only way today to make them a good person is to teach them Torah. It depends, you know, what you want. I mentioned Eilu Metziyot, a critique of, you know, teaching Eilu Metziyot today to kids in grade 5 doesn't make any sense because it's so difficult and they don't understand. It can be a turn off tomorrow. On the other hand, Rav Moshe Feinstein, I heard in the name of Rav Moshe Feinstein, I never met Rav Moshe, unfortunately. But I heard in his name, they quoted that he said, a beautiful, why did we start with Eilu Metziyot? Because it's the mitzvah of Hashavat Avita. It's the mitzvah of returning a lost object. So the first message we want to teach children when we teach Talmud is to return a lost object, that to be caring about other people. And it's not, it's the moral lesson. In other words, and you see already Rav Moshe, we're not just, who cares, Machlok and Vayva Rabba, like when's that going to come up in your life? You know, you found something, you don't know if the person gave up hope, but the idea of sensitivity to others is very important. So that's what Rav Chanina ben Dosa, this pious person who his ability to pray apparently would determine who would be alive and who would not. And the merit of the world was sustained because of him. Yeah, learning is very nice, but learning is only a means to an end. And that's the end, to develop your character, to be a much greater person. Reshit Chachma Yirat Hashem, right? The beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. Okay, the Gemara in Shabbos quotes that when it quotes the six orders of the Mishnah, you know, it talks about, that's the Mishnah that talks about the six questions that you'll be asked. We're coming to Rosh Hashanah. The six questions will be asked on the final day of judgment when we at 120. So nasat, each one, Zraim is Nasata Benatata Be'emuna. Moed is Kavati Tim Lator. In other words, there's a link between the orders of the Talmud and the question asked. And then, but the Talmud quotes all this, and then Yirat Hashem Hi Otsaro. The fear of God is the storehouse. In other words, all the learning is kind of meaningless if it doesn't come together with fear of God. If learning doesn't make you a better person, then your learning is wrong. The truth of the matter, that's one of the dangers sometimes. In teaching Talmud, it's a double-edged sword. This perhaps is what the Rambam is saying, referring to teaching a Talmud Sheino Hagun. When you learn Bava Metzia and Bava Kama, I hate to say this, but just to understand, it's an important, I think it's important. One can develop, you learn how to cheat. In other words, one of the things you learn, anybody know what an amigo is? Amigo is, believe me on claim A, because if I was a lawyer, I would say claim B. So yes. My claim A should be believed, because if I'm lying, I could give you a better claim. So the Talmud has all these examples of the psychology of lying. So, you know, you learn about this. What's Bava Metzia about? Somebody mentioned they learn two people holding a talit. That's the first chapter in Bava Metzia. Shnai moksim b'talit, two people are holding a piece of clothing. Zomer kulo shali, v'zomer kulo shali. This says it's all mine. This says it's all mine. Now, obviously, one of them is lying. Can't be both of them all there. And therefore, they each have to take an oath that I don't own less than half. It's a very weird worded oath. They can't take an oath that they own the whole thing, because then you're forcing one of them to potentially take an oath they're going to lie. Some people, they won't back down. So if both people take an oath, it's both theirs. One of them is lying. So we don't want them to be in a position to force them both. We can't tell them to take an oath that it's half theirs because they claim it's all of theirs. So the Mishnah comes up, they have to take this oath. I don't own less than half. Because right away we're introduced, this one's lying, this one's lying, who's cheating. So if you learn Gemara just like that, you learn how to be a better crook. And unfortunately, there are people who pick up on that. I don't have to tell you some of the swindles, the business shenanigans that go on are from people who learned in yeshiva, because they picked up some of this stuff. I saw this week four brothers were arrested. I don't know if the people see it. They cheated Amazon out of $19 million, whatever. It's a terrible thing. So that's really what the fear, I think, of the Rambam was. If a person doesn't have Yirat Shamayim, You can learn Eilim Metzius, you can learn Bava Metzius, how important it is to learn to return a lost object, but you also learn when I don't have to return it, I can keep it. You can learn, you know, two people can learn the same thing. One takes a negative lesson, one takes a positive lesson. So that's what Rav Chanina ben Dosa is saying. Your fear of heaven has to precede knowledge. Your base of knowledge has to be fear of sin. Okay. Then the Mishnah continues a similar idea. Maybe you have to, what's the difference? Hu hayah omer, Rav Chanina ben Dosa continues, ko shemasa merubim mechachmato. One whose actions are greater than his wisdom. Chachmato mitkayemet, his wisdom has endurance. Ko shechachmato merubam mimasav. But anybody whose wisdom is greater than his actions, in chachmato mitkayemet. More important to do than to learn. Your actions have to be greater than what you do. So this is an old debate. I mean, again, without getting into technical halakhic things, because we know learning Torah is sort of it's an action in itself, but it leads to action. It leads you to be a greater person. But the Talmud itself has a fascinating argument. I think the word says for 3 years, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel argued about this. What's more important, learning or doing? Doing mitzvah, because learning is also mitzvah. Learning Torah, connecting with God's words, you know, developing, learning our most sacred possession, or, you know, helping people, going visit people in the hospital, and all the acts of kindness that we can do. What's greater? So this, for arguing backwards, and the Gemara comes to the conclusion, it's like the conclusion is so funny. The conclusion is, learning is more important. Why? Because learning leads to action. Talmud may be leading. So you have to learn, because learning leads to action. So what's more important? So obviously action is more important. But the way to get to action is through learning. That's also a fascinating teaching of our sages. We know it's not always true. We know that just because people learn, they don't know. That's the difference between, in theory, between a yeshiva and a university. In a yeshiva, the learning is supposed to be develop your character, be a better person. In university, you can be the biggest lowlife in the world. No problem with that. And as long as you're a big scholar, that's all that counts. It's the information. We distinguish between the person teaching and the information. In the Gemara says that the teachers of Torah have to be like if a person is close to God, you can learn Torah. The truth of the matter, it's also a debate. Rav Meir would learn from Acher. Exactly what the relationship is between learning and like, can you learn from a teacher who's a sinner? So that's a whole debate in Talmud. Fascinating. For another time, we can perhaps go into some of the fascinating approaches to this question. But everybody agrees the purpose of learning is to make you a better person. That's unlike in the university system. So when somebody learns, I'm not saying that's bad necessarily. It's a different model of learning. The goal of university, character is come somewhere else. Okay, maybe the Greeks didn't believe in that. Probably the Greeks did believe learning was to develop character too. But it's a whole different idea. Okay, Seder. So when you see people who learn a lot, but their action is wanting, it just doesn't just mean their action is wanting. It means their learning isn't very good. In other words, there's something wrong with their learning. If learning doesn't lead to action, it's not good. But, okay, the Bartanura says the first half of the Mishnah that Yirat Chet refers to negative commandments, and Masim refers to positive commandments. That's not the way I explained it. I don't think you have to say it like that. You can say Yirat Chet is all sins, all the mitzvot of the Torah, and chokma and masav is carrying out mitzvot, whether they're positive, negative, whatever. But he sort of makes this distinction. You know, something negative is yira, is fear, and masim is love. Actually, it's this week's, you know, parsha. We have the famous principle, I think, this week's parsha. Gedilim tasela lo tovash shaknes. The Torah juxtaposes the mitzvah of tzitzis. We know tzitzis in Shlach Lecha, by we say in the Shema, but it's also in this week's parsha. Gedilim, like fringes you should make for yourself and put on your clothing. And then says, don't wear any shaknes. So what's the connection? And we know, especially in the book of Dvarim, and we know in any book, it's not just the content, but form is often equally made sometimes more important than context. What's put next to what? So the Gemara says these two are put next to each other, that if you have a garment, a linen garment and wool tzitzis, it's shatnes, that's okay, you can wear it. If that's all you have, well, maybe even if others, gedilim tasalacha, that you can asay dochel lo tasay. A positive mitzvah overrides a negative mitzvah. Right, so you have a choice. I can abandon the mitzvah of tzitzit, or I can do tzitzit and violate the mitzvah of shatnes. So the Talmud says, "Asei dochel lo tasei." It's a discussion in Yevamot, because you marry your sister-in-law that you're not allowed to marry. That's also in a way an example of asei dochel lo tasei. So the Ramban beautifully explains why, because a mitzvah tasei, it reflects love of God, and a mitzvah lo tasei, yira, it reflects the fear of God. And love is greater than fear. It's more important to love God than to fear God or to be in awe of God. So, asay dochel lo tasay. Now, this question bothered me for a long time, what I'm going to say now, and then, or whatever. I don't know why people don't ask this question all the time. The question that asay dochel lo tasay doesn't make any sense on the surface. Why not? I don't want to test anybody. But because we have another principle. The other principle we have is mitzvah ba aveira. You're not allowed to do a sin in order to do a mitzvah. The classic case, this is the Gemara, I think my kids, when they first started learning in Nitivot, I think this is the Gemara they first started teaching, Sukkah, Lulav HaGazul. It's the first Gemara. I learned this in high school also. But I learned Eilu Metzius in grade 7, Hamafkid in grade 8. Hamafkid, it's also a very difficult thing, but in grade Baba Batra in grade 10, I remember Sukkah. I don't know if it was grade 11. I don't remember now exactly when, but we learned Sukkah when I was in high school. And the third chapter, lulav hagazul, a stolen lulav is no good. Why would somebody steal a lulav? Whatever, whole interesting thing. Why not? Mitzvah of avera. I mean, there are two reasons, whatever. We're not going to go into it here. But it says, especially after the first day, because I can't steal and do a mitzvah. If I do a sin, the ends don't justify the means. I can't sin in order to do a mitzvah. What kind of a mitzvah is it if I sin? If I steal your love, I don't pay taxes, I cheat on my taxes and I give charity. What kind of charity is that? It's not your money. I have to give charity with my money, not with the government's money, not with the other people's money. So mitzvah, but so how can the Torah tell you, asay dochel lo tasay, how can you wear tzitzis that have shatnes? How can you do that? So I think the answer to me, obvious answer is, it depends if we're talking about mitzvot between man and man and God. When it comes to man and man, I cannot steal from you to do a mitzvah. That's a terrible thing. There's no mitzvah. When it comes to God, shatnes, sitzes, what does that have to do with my relationship to you? It has nothing to do with that. It's my relationship to God. So God has one mitzvah I have to wear where sitzes. God has another mitzvah, don't wear shatnes. They're in conflict with each other. What do I do? So God says, you know what? Show your love toward me. That's more important than your fear of me. Wear it. But don't harm somebody else. That you're not allowed to do. That you're not allowed to steal from anybody else. But you see here in these Mishnayot, the importance that learning is really, learning has to lead to action. Learning has to lead to fear of God. Knowledge is wonderful. But, you know, we know how dangerous knowledge can be. When science gets ahead of morality, when and it applies in all fields, that That's a big issue we struggle with. And we see sometimes some of the most, brilliant people, some of are often very ethically wanting. And the Torah's approach is totally different. And I think sometimes, again, today there's been a sort of an overemphasis on learning. It's easy learning. I mean, learn this. Developing character is hard. The Musar movement, Rabbi Rekepet talks about this a lot. Those who know Rabbi Rekepet, the Musar movement was in a sense unsuccessful. Nobody wants to hear it be better. It didn't. It never caught on. And even the Sabbat Yeshiva broke up over it and tells things never, there was fights there. It was how many people learn Musar? They study Mesilat Yesharim and Shari Tshuva. And it's people don't want to be told. And it's an implied critique that you have to do this better and you have to do that better. People didn't like it. And it implies the Talmud doesn't do that. That's Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, famously said, Musar is for people who are sick. So you have to give them medicine, but we're not sick. We learn Talmud, we're not sick. You can, I'm not sure that whatever, but that's what he said. So the Musar movement never was popular because it involved self-criticism. It was hard work. As Rav Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement, said, it's easier to go through the entire Talmud than to change one character trait. We know that. We know how hard it is to learn the entire Talmud. Yeah, you got a Daf Yomishi every day for 7.5 years. You listen online, beautiful. But to change, that's much, much harder. People aren't interested in such hard work. So the Muslim movement never caught on. The Hasidic movement, wow. Hasidic movement swept Europe. Why? Because what did the Hasidim say? The founding of Hasidim. Hasidim was founded in a very dark point in Jewish history. The middle of the 1700s, 1800s was a very dark point. It was not so long after the Chmelnytsky massacres, the aftermath of the Holocaust. Not so long after Tisha B'Av Tzvi, there was tremendous poverty. When did Hasidim come? Be happy, make a kid. Instead of on a yahrzeit, the Shulchan Aruch says you fast. That's what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. Not a halacha, it's a custom. I know of only two people who ever told me they fasted on a yahrzeit. And the one person I remember, he only fasted half a day, not to eat on your yahrzeit. Well, obviously, a yahrzeit is a sad day. It's tshuva, right? We mourn. Shiva is an act of repentance to figure, our mortality. That's Rav Soloveitchik explained. The whole purpose of sitting Shiva is not the whole purpose, but one of the key purposes to do tshuva, to repent, to reflect on life, So what was I saying? That's like that's what we do in I just lost my train of thought for a second. Somebody want to say what I was saying about
fasting on a yahrzeit?
Yeah, fast on your. Oh, right, the Hasidim. Thank you very much. The Hasidim came along and said, we're going to eat on a yahrzeit. We're going to make a kiddush. That's what the country. The Hasidim stressed the joy of life, singing, connecting to a person. And you don't have to work hard. You go to the Rebbe. The Rebbe prays on your behalf. I mean, that was a problem, perhaps. But the Hasidic movement swept Europe. The Musar, how many be Musarniks? So, people don't like that. So it's very hard. It's very easy to focus on learning, but not so, it's very much harder to focus on development of character. Okay, just let's do one more Mishnah. Hu haya omer, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa said, Kol sheruach habriyot nocheh hamenu. This gets into what I was just saying before on the difference between mitzvot to man and man and man to God. Ruach hamakom nocheh hamenu. If ruach habriyot, it's hard to translate the word ruach. If people are happy with you, people are pleasant, your people enjoy your company, then God is happy with you. But if people don't like you, or you're not pleasant with people don't find you a nice person, then God will not be pleased with you. So that's, again, very obvious. God cares much more about how we treat other people than how we treat him. And of course, everybody is created in the image of God. So if you want to know what it is, how a person really thinks about God, it's meaningless. And we pray to God, it's see how they act towards man, because man is created in the image of God. And therefore that reflects what we do. So God's not very happy. Tiferet Yisrael here quotes the Gemara in Yuma that I like to quote a lot. Bahapta Hashem Elokecha, the mitzvah to love God. He reads it the ihapta, not to love God. I mean, but to make others love God, to cause God to be loved. The mitzvah of loving God means causing others. And how do we do that? And the Gemara uses that exact same language. Noach Hemenu, Ruach HaBriyot Noach Hemenu. The spirit of people is comfortable with him. It says if a person is nice and he's honest, Nasata V'Natata V'Emunah, he conducts his business honestly, he speaks nicely, so people say, wow, how great is this person? Look, how blessed is he that his father teaches him Torah. Because he learns Torah, he's such a nice, wonderful person. But if a person is not nice and he's dishonest and he doesn't get along with people and he learns Torah, people say how terrible that this is. This person learned Torah and he turned into a creep. I don't want to learn Torah. This I've asked many people. No one's given me an answer. The implication of this Gemara is that if you're going to cheat and you're not going to be nice, better don't be observant. Because when you quote unquote keep the mitzvah between man and God, you create a chilul Hashem. If the guy who cheats in business has the kippah on, it's much worse. Take off your kippah.
Yes.
Don't eat treif. You know, it's that. That's what the Gemara seems to say, because it's going to reflect badly. If a guy's not religious, no one will say, oh, he's religious, that's why he cheats. But if a guy's a long beard and a hat, well, it may not be fair, but that's the reality of life. That's people do judge you, unfortunately. So like that. So and they don't distinguish between Jews and Judaism. That's what the Gemara says. So that's the mitzvah. You have to make sure people love you. Okay, let me just quickly do review. We started the importance of review. So just and then I'll get to, I see there are a couple of questions here. Okay, we discussed prayer and learning being sort of two opposite mitzvot, the importance of not forgetting, whether it applies today or not, because we have computers and everything written down. That's, to me, really a side point. That's a technical question. But the idea that learning is you have to know it and you have to review it, even though that's harder for people. We always like new and exciting. Yes, it's hyperbola. You're not really guilty to lose, you know, of your soul just because you forgot things. But okay. And then we discussed a little bit on Rav Chanina ben Dosa, his power of prayer. He was a righteous person. We have, I think, Rav Soloveitchik, you said that the Chafetz Chaim was like the Chanina ben Dosa of his generation. I think I heard it. The Chafetz Chaim, the great saintly, pious person. He's the person you went to when you had problems. We know that certain rabbis are great for intellect and learning, and so the rabbis have it's a different. That was the whole idea of the Muslim movement. You created a mashkiach. He was for spiritual growth. The Rosh Yeshiva was for intellectual growth. They worked together, and the comparison or the between learning, fear of God, action. What the Mishnah clearly seems to be saying is action and character is much more important than learning. Maybe even it's negative to learn if you don't develop action. Even perhaps a prohibition in theory. Today, of course, the way to get back, and of course, when I say sin, I want to clarify, I think it's very important, especially in our times, when I say, I don't mean a person who doesn't keep kosher. Like, I mean a person who cheats and is not nice and gossip. When we're talking, because people, you can be of excellent moral character and be non-observant. In the time of the Talmud didn't have that distinction because the whole society was a religious society. There was an understanding. If you didn't keep Shabbos, that meant you're rejecting God and you don't care about anything. You're unethical. That, of course, isn't true anymore at all. So when I say about a person, you can't teach an improper student Torah, what the Rambam says, that wouldn't apply to someone who's not Shomer Shabbos. That would be ridiculous in our time.
Yes.
But the question is, someone whose character is very deficient and you teach him how to give an argument that I could have given a bigger argument, amigo, teach out of law, maybe not. And then we discussed a little bit educational policy. You have to know the generation, right? What do you teach? And on the one hand, we want to teach people the importance of helping Elam Metziat, right, to return a lost object. But you have to be careful. Knowledge misused is very dangerous. We all know that. Knowledge can be used and misused. And we talked a little bit about the founding of the Muslim movement and why it wasn't so popular. And of course, the importance that, and then the love of God and fear of God, love is greater. And the distinction between love of going over fear, a positive mitzvah is more important than a negative mitzvah between man and God. But between man and man, that would be a mitzvah above a vera. That's where a sin, a mitzvah done through the means of a sin, was inappropriate and is unacceptable. Okay, let me just quickly see questions here. I think there are a couple of questions. Let me just... Somebody wrote me privately. Let me see. Chassidut and Reform start in the same era. Can I interpret the Chassidut also? Yes, I think the Chassidut was not Chassidic. I don't think he was really involved. In the battle against Chassidus. That was mainly in Lithuania. The Chatam Sofer, of course, is in Hungary and born in Germany. Chatam Sofer wrote every tshuva the Chatam Sofer wrote. He wrote at the bottom, Frankfurt. And Moshe HaKatan Sofer from Frankfurt. He left Frankfurt as a teenager, never ever returned, never went back to visit his mother. There's lots of stories there, not for now. The Chatam Sofer, then he's hungry. I don't think he was really involved in the fight against Chassidus. I'm not expert enough. I have to look that up a little, but yes, he was not Hasidic at all. By the way, I often note that if you read, it doesn't mean anything. It could be the style of the writers, but if you read the language the rabbis wrote against Chassidut and the language they wrote against Reform, the language against, you know, Chassidut was harsher. In other words, they're destroying Judaism more than the Reform. I mean, they wrote harsh about both of them, but the language on Chassidut, the harshness, I mean, you know, they saw the Hasidic movement as totally destructive, they had some reasons, perhaps. They weren't totally wrong. And some people want to claim, if not for the opposition, the Hasidic movement may have gone off the rails, may have totally become totally un-Jewish, the Shabtai Tzvi, you know, like other movements in history, that perhaps the opposition kept the Hasidic movement, you know, in the fold a little bit. But anyways, yes, there are people who are against Hasidus and against Reform. It is true, as the speaker on the Chemia said, that you are able to dispense with the rabbinic law of your official government services. Okay, that's right. Okay, I'm not sure why they're relevant to what I said now, but yes, people in government positions can violate rabbinic law very often. We know that. Shalom Malkut, get along. There are all kinds of things we can do. I'll take it at the end. I'm sorry. Let me get through the other question, then I'm happy to listen. Practically, a law with the reason, again, this is something privately, is easier to change than if it wasn't meant for our case. Yeah, again, when laws are allowed to change, that requires a whole other shear. It's an important topic. There are times, but generally, we all know in the secular world too, as it should be, law has to be interpreted independently. There's a whole legal theory debate, you know, original intent of the law. That's not for now. It's an important discussion, but generally, in every system, in halakha and in Western jurisprudence, there's a law has to be applied even when the reason doesn't apply. Now, it could reach a point where the law is taken off the books. But, and that can happen in Judaism too. And there are cases. There are, for example, you're not allowed to drink water that was left unattended because a snake may get its poison. We don't follow that law anymore. Whatever, other laws. Okay. Chief Rabbi Shar Yeshur Cohen of Haifa introduced testing and levels. Yeah. You know, for sure, there are Hasidic rabbis who introduced testing. Yeah. I'm saying Telz was the first in Europe to do it. We're talking 1800s. Telz was founded around 1881, something like that, to do testing. A lot of these yeshivas had tests to get in. But once you were in, but they knew the students. These were the people who went to yeshiva then, they were super dedicated. What they were masmidim, they would learn 20 hours a day. I mean, they were wild kids, some of them. You read the book, they were rebellious and they didn't accept authority. It was very different than the yeshivas of today. They went on strike in Telz. Telz went on a strike for 4 or 5 months, like the NBA and the NHL, but for a totally different reason. Not make fun. No, I mean, strikes are very important. They send a very powerful message. And they went on strike because they didn't like who they appointed as rebbeim and this and that. The students were a lot different. Anyways.
Okay. Can you please repeat what about fasting on your side? What you said? Because my computer froze then.
I'm sorry?
About fasting on your side. What did you say about fasting on your side?
I said that the law in the Shulchan Aruch is you fast on the law. The custom is you fast on a yortzeit, because for good reasons, to do tshuva, the point of sitting of a yortzeit, that point is to return, to improve our life, to say, what can I, we're going to die, we're mortal, let's make our life serious, like fasting on Yom Kippur. The purpose is to do tshuva, to repent. The Hasidic movement came along and turned the Yahrzeit into a festive day. It's ridiculous. You think about it logically. You make a Kiddush. Every shul around the world, every week, somebody sponsors Kiddush because they have Yahrzeit. It's ridiculous. I'm not saying to do it. I'm saying think about it logically. It makes your parents died. Let's drink. Let's have a l'chaim.
So, of course,
they're doing it. The soul is elevating. We want it to light. But the idea is so strange. But the Hasidic movement is very popular. Eating, singing. You didn't have to learn too much. It wasn't hard. Muslim movement is really hard. No, it's true.
That's true. Right.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Thank you.
I think Musa was taught at the gate. I think Gates said, sure. Reb Dessler was Greg Musternick. No, Musa had some success that many yeshivas they did for. But even where a lot of places they did it for 20 minutes a day, people, a lot of people didn't take it seriously. Yes, Reb Dessler was a famous. He was, and then the Mashgiach in Ponovich went from Gates to Ponovich, wrote the Michta Me'Eliyahu. Okay. I think that's it. We can stop now. I don't know exactly. You can let me know what you think, but I was thinking I'll do one, maybe two more weeks of Pirkei Avot, and then at least a week or two before Rosh Hashanah, we can talk a little bit about Rosh Hashanah, but you can let me know. And I hope you saw, I sent out the Elul schedule that we're starting next Thursday. Mm-hmm. I invite everybody who hasn't come on Tuesday, we're doing our Siyum on Tanakh, right? The 24 books. So we'll have that. We should bring a l'chaim and make a kiddush. Your own individual kiddush. Have a l'chaim. Rabbi Liebtag is going to be finishing off the Divrei HaYamim, and so we look forward to learning with you, etc. Somebody here, like, I missed this. Rabbi Meir, yeah, the bad parts. Yeah, that's all. And again, privately, the idea of learning from people who aren't righteous. When yes, when not. There's a lot to discuss, and then we have to discuss, of course, what happens after Rosh Hashanah when Pirkei Avot is over. If we want to continue, what we should learn, etc. So I'm open to ideas, but thank you. I want to wish everybody a wonderful day and Shabbat Shalom.
Good job.
And thank you very much. Okay, thank be you. Well, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Rabbi?
Yeah?
Have a time for a question?
Sure.
Yes, yes. So, look, I was, you know, this idea that the Talmud Bavli is so bad, much better edited than the Yerushalmi. This amazes me that you said in Yerushalayim there's more oppression, and in Golos, in Bavel, there was less apparently, so that, and they produced a finer product. I find this, what you would, you know, it's strange. It's what's the word? Unintuitive. It seems to be the wrong way around.
So no, because, listen, when the Israel was in control of foreign authorities. The Babylonian different Israel. You know, they there was a lot of the people ruling Israel. They made it very very difficult for the Jewish people. We know, like there was a golden age in Spain. There are times where America is a wonderful exile. Canada is a wonderful diaspora. We live here free and to do whatever we want. And you know we can accomplish a lot. When you're living under the threat of anti-Semitism, it's hard to do things. You know.
So was that the time of Emperor Hadrian? I mean, maybe.
No, the Hadrianic persecutions were earlier. We're in the 130s. That's Rabbi Kiva. That's in the second century. I'm talking about in the third, fourth century. So the Yerushalmi never got properly fully edited.
Because of the
most of the rabbis left. Most of the rabbis went to Babel. And it was harder. They didn't have the system. The Babylonian Talmud was edited with great precision. And over like many years. I mean, we don't know this, you know, the scholarship, we don't know exactly everything. Just we don't know, you know, a lot of things, but you know, there's a lot of, they do a lot of research in it, but it's clear when you study the Talmud how precisely edited it is. It's really beautiful. And that's something that's we don't teach at all, which I think is unfortunate, because I think kids who get turned off to them, the Talmud just goes a rambling discussion here and over there. There's a method to the madness, and it's very precise. And why they decided to put this story on this page, it's not something people paid attention to in Europe, and nobody cared. And then they would skip those parts of the Gemara. They were only interested in the halachic parts. Today in Israel, there's a revival of many learning styles that were dormant for many years. The way Tanakh is studied in the modern Orthodox world in Israel is very different than it was studied historic for the last few hundred years. You know, things where we've come back to Israel and Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem. So there's a lot of new flourishing scholarship in many, many areas, and it's wonderful. But I know that's an area there are a few people who, you know, they read about. That's what they're, you know, the relationship between Agada and Halakha. Typically, people sort of ignored it. They were this and that. They intertwine. The Agada, I mean, Rav Soloveitchik would speak about it. Rav Soloveitchik never would skip Agada when he taught. Any rabbis, they skipped that part. Rabbi Salvi. So the Agada reflects the Halakha.
Yes.
And the Halakha reflects the Agada. The Halakha is the practical application of the Agada. And the Agada is the moral, ethical teachings behind the Halakha.
So the historical thing is the top rabbis, for whatever reason, were in Bavel. Is that the point?
The major rabbis were by the 4th, 5th century, sure. Yeah, the major rabbis were in Babel. Not in the 2nd century. But when Rav came to Babel, it was a wasteland. Rav came to Babel, the Gemara story. Rav dies in 219. Rav is the student, one of the top students of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Mishnah. So Rav comes to Babel, he founds the yeshiva in Sura, which exists for 800 years. It was a meat bar, sir. Babel was a wasteland. But eventually it overtook Israel. The Gemara talks about the difference in learning. Babel was more harsh. There's a lot to discuss here, but for another time.
For another
time. Shabbos.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Have a show.